So last week during the meeting, there was the subject of the Kennicott-Schmidt law came up. So I've been working on this, and I thought I would say a few words about it. In particular, what happens when you apply the Kennicott-Schmidt law to high redshift, to the neutral gas reservoirs that we know that exist at high redshift, damp Lyman alpha systems. And this is work I've been doing with Shaolin Chen at University of Chicago. So almost everything we know, virtually everything we know about star formation at high redshift comes from looking at starlight. And in particular, we've heard a lot about the Lyman-Bray galaxies, which are detected by using the dropout technique, making use of the fact that the universe is optically thick at the Lyman limit above a redshift of 3. So if you look, for example, at B-band dropouts, the 912 angstroms gets shifted to the blue band, and there'll be no flux in broadband blue using the blue filter, but the object will be visible in the B filter. So this is such a series of objects that have been detected in the Hubble ultra deep field. So a lot of interesting things about this, but the only thing I'm going to concentrate today on two properties. One, that these objects are very compact, these very high redshift objects. They're typically 2/10 of an arc second in diameter. That's the same in all bands, not just at blue wavelengths, at rest frame FUV radiation. So they're typically 1 or 2 kiloparsecs, or maybe a little bit more in diameter. And that means they have a very low area filling factor. They integrate all the way using the luminosity function at a 28th magnitude. They don't fill up more than 1/1000th of the sky. But yet they're very high surface brightness. Okay, and remember, the luminosity in the FUV radiation tells you the star instantaneous star formation rate at the same redshift. So they have a very high star formation rate. Now, of course, that's only half the story. Of course, these stars have to come out of somewhere, and they come out of gas, of course. And all the gas that we know about at high redshift that's capable of making stars lies in the damp Lyman alpha systems. And this is a spectrum of a typical high redshift quasar. And about 1 out of every 3 quasars is Lyman alpha emission. This is the usual Lyman alpha forest. These are ionized gas clouds. But 1 out of 3 shows a very strong Lyman alpha line broadened by radiation damping. And it has a very high column density. In fact, we define these systems to have a threshold column density greater than 2 × 10^20, because when you get much lower than this, the gas is going to be ionized, and we want to make sure the gas is neutral. So they have a lot of interesting properties, but the characteristics I'm going to stress in this talk, as I said, the gas is neutral. The metallicity is low. The median metallicity is about -1.3 dex × solar, about 1/20th, 1/30th. The solar abundance. The way we determine the metallicity is by looking at low ion absorption lines like singly ionized silicon and iron. And these are probably the most accurate metallicities we have at high redshift coming from these objects, because we know the ionization state of the gas. And interestingly, the molecular fraction is very low, looking at Lyman and Werner band absorption, maybe 10%. We really don't know that number yet. Show molecular absorption, and when you see it, the molecular fraction is low.
How many metal ion systems per damp system?
What do you mean by that? You mean other redshift systems? You mean?
Actually, for a given damp system.
Everyone has had metals.
Yeah, but have you ever seen? Have you seen multiple components?
Oh yeah, sure. We see multi components. The median velocity intervals 90 kilometers a second. We see them sometimes after 300. Probably then we're really looking at two systems.
The multiplicity is a 4 or 5.
Well, it depends how you define it. If you can separate the damp Lyman alpha lines, that means they have to be more than a few thousand kilometers a second. And there it's consistent with random, you know, what you'd expect for Poisson distribution. Although we do think that they're probably correlated with each other. But
excuse me, what absorption line do you use for molecular fraction?
Lyman and Werner band. Lyman and Werner band. So it's very sensitive. Right? Very, very.
I was going to ask about that. Has anyone done the experiment of looking at a nearby galaxy? The Lyman and Werner bands, and did you do some more? That's not how we usually.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, Tomlinson and Scholl have done that. And the molecular fraction is much higher, if that's what you're asking me.
But is it 1?
No, it depends. In the Milky Way, it's 10^-1. We integrate over the whole Milky Way. Because remember, these are diffuse clouds. These are not GMCs.
Okay.
For the SMC, it's about 10 to minus, it's a little bit less than that, it's about 10 to minus 2.
But so you're seeing a certain fraction of molecular gas, not the sun, molecular gas that we form in stars. So
we're not looking at giant molecular clouds. We're looking at diffuse clouds that have molecules in them. That's right. I mean, it's a selection effect against that anyway. We couldn't. There's so much dust, we couldn't see the background laser. Okay, and the statistic, at least, that I want to stress in this talk is the H1 column density distribution function. We now have, from the Sloan survey that we've done, we have about over 1,000 of these things, which is a tremendous benefit for us. We only had about 80 when we about 2 years ago. So this is the number of objects per unit of column density interval and some absorption distance, which is not that important. But there are two characteristics. First, it cannot be fit by a single power law. A single power law can be rejected with high confidence, so it has to be a double power law. There's definitely a break over here, which is important for a number of reasons. I'm going to talk about that later. The other, at about 3 times 10 to the 21 particles per square centimeter, the highest column density system that we've seen so far is about 8 times 10 to the 21. And secondly, if you integrate under this curve, okay, not just in column density, but also on a redshift, you get the area covering factor of the damp Lyman alpha systems. And unlike the Lyman break galaxies, they cover an enormous fraction of the sky, about 1/3, between a redshift of 2.5 and 3.5. So I'll just compare what we know about stars and gas at high redshift. First, the co-moving star formation density at a redshift of 3, we heard talks about that last week. And the lower limit, say, at this redshift is some number like this, 10 to the minus 1.5 solar masses per year per cubic megaparsecs. If I correct for reddening, because the Lyman break galaxies are reddened, then it could be as high as 10 to the minus 0.8. And so they have a high co-moving star formation density, and as I said before, in this redshift interval, they have a very low area covering factor. And this is in stark contrast. All the gas that could potentially make stars at high redshift where the area covering factor is 1/3 the sky. So, you know, this raises a lot of obvious questions. Do the damp Lyman alpha systems undergo in situ star formation? Does the gas that we see actually form stars? And if it does, how does the co-moving star formation density compare to that of star-forming galaxies like the Lyman break galaxies? Or the other possibility is that what you see is what you get, that at high redshift, all the star formation only occurs in these compact systems. And I'm including the kind of objects that Bruce will talk about, the chain galaxies and the tadpoles and all these things. They're generally very compact. And if star formation is only confined to compact objects, then what is the relationship between this neutral gas reservoir and the objects that form stars? Are they reservoirs for star formation in the LPG? So one thing that occurred to us a couple years ago is one way to make this connection is to use the Kennecott-Schmidt law, of course, which is well established at low redshift. And schematically, it's usually done for disk galaxies, that the star formation rate per unit area perpendicular to the disk as a function of the H1 column density, or the total H column density as a function of this, above a threshold goes like a power law. And I'll just call this threshold column density the critical column density. And one way to see this is a talk that Crystal Martin gave at a talk we had in San Diego in last December on the Kennecott-Schmidt law. And so what she's done here is these are two spiral galaxies. We just focus on this one. So what we see here is the H alpha surface brightness, which gives you the star formation rate per unit area. And what's plotted here is total surface density going this way to the left. So you can see that below about a few solar masses per square parsec, there's no star formation. And then once you get above that, it pops up and it obeys the power law pretty well. And here she's plotting it versus radius. You can see it again, the star formation rate going down to some threshold. And in the same curve, she's also, the units aren't here, but you can see a rotation curve showing that there's no mass truncation over here. The dark matter just keeps going. But what I really like about this curves that she's done, that here she plots, this is molecular H2 column density inferred from CO observations. So the molecules are really plummeting over here, but the H1 surface density keeps going. And this curve over here, the green curve, is the total. So what's interesting about this is even though the molecular fraction is going down a lot, you still have a significant amount of star formation. And this has led to their idea that what really determines the star formation is the total H surface density, not just the molecular. Although there's a lot of debate about that, but I don't want to get into all that. Leo Blitz would be jumping all over me if he were in this room. Right? All right. And this is the critical comb density from the tomb rate criterion. The grid. All right. Okay. Oh yeah, I mean, whenever you see star formation, it has to be molecules, but these are the azimuthal averages.
Right, but maybe sort of second order thing, since you have to have enough H1 to be able to get some H2.
I agree. Okay, and then here's the Kennecott-Schmidt law and all. Here are the individual points. What's so miraculous about that, this is an average over each one of these points is an individual galaxy. And these are very different types of objects. These are disk galaxies. I think these are starbursts. I forgot what these are, crystal maybe. But you can see over four or five orders of magnitude, this is very tight correlation.
Even though, I forgot, did you do an average over the entire disk?
Yeah. Okay. Over the star forming disk. Yeah.
So it's within that threshold.
Right. Okay, so how can we use it at high redshift? So what I'm going to make an assumption now is that these H1 layers that we see at high redshift are planar layers. That's at least what, we don't know that for sure, but it's very, I think, a reasonable assumption. At least it shows up in all the simulations that to keep this gas neutral, you collapse and you make something that looks like a layer. And let's suppose it's radiating through the Kennecott law, and I'm looking at this object along the line of sight. So the intensity is just an integral over a source function. There's very little opacity in the damn Lyman alpha systems. And that means that the intensity is just equal to the star formation rate, it's equal to the luminosity per unit area projected along the line of sight. And all that is really the luminosity per unit area perpendicular to the line of sight projected, perpendicular to the plane projected along the line of sight. And why that's interesting is because for FUV radiation, the luminosity per unit area at a given time is just proportional to the star formation rate per unit area at the same time. Now, of course, when we look at these objects in absorption, we have no idea what the inclination angle is. So we did the next best thing is to average over all inclination angles, use the Kennecott law. And what we find is that the average intensity is proportional to this quantity, psi star dat, which looks just like the Kennecott law, has the same constant. But instead of having the column density perpendicular to the plane, it's the observed column density. And of course, it falls off like 1 plus z cubed because of the redshift losses.
You expect a significant amount of scatter because of that inclination.
Sure. But we have lots of observations, so that's why that's taken into account. So for example, for a column density of about 10 to 21, which is about twice the median, what you come out with is star formation rate per unit area, which is about three times the Milky Way rate, 10 to minus 2 solar masses per year per square kiloparsec. So at a redshift of 3, the surface brightness turns out to be about 28.4 magnitudes per square second, which sounds very faint, but it turns out that this is measurable with the Hubble, with the ACS camera on the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, especially the visual. So we can detect if these, what I'm saying is that this, if these objects are forming stars at the Kennecott rate, we should be able to detect them. Well, the next thing is, how do you compute the co-moving star formation density due to gas? So it's different than doing it for stars. And for us, in the spherically symmetric limit, it's just given by this integral. And really what I'm doing here is the column density distribution function dn times f of n, all that really is a differential area times a co-moving density. And I'm plotting the co-moving density times the differential area times the star formation rate per unit area. So that's how I get a co-moving star formation density. It's more complicated than that, but that's basically what it is. And what's nice about this is that this column density distribution function is very well determined. we think we know the Kennecott relationship, so we should be able to predict what the co-moving star formation density is due to gas greater than a given column density. So this is the result of this cumulative quantity. And this calculation, I've gone one step further. I've done this for randomly oriented disks, not in a spherically symmetric limit. And it agrees with this to within 40%. It's very similar, so it doesn't really matter. But what's interesting about this is that if I go all the way down, not even down to 2 times 10 to the 20, down to, you know, a few times 10 to the 20, 5 or 6 times 10 to the 20, 10 to 21, which is where the Kennecott thresholds, Kennecott-Schmidt thresholds are, you can see that the co-moving star formation density is very similar to that of the Lyman break galaxies. So what this means is that, you know, one-third of the universe should be lit up and forming stars, if this is correct. Now, how many should we expect to see? That's a straightforward calculation. In the Hubble ultra deep field, in this redshift interval, we know what the area covering factor is. It's one-third of the sky. We just take the Hubble ultra deep field, which has a solid angle of 10 square arc minutes, divide that by 3, and let's assume and make a naive assumption that all DLAs have the same solid angle. And these are the predictions for DLAs at different solid angles, or different angle diameters. So 4 arc seconds at a redshift of 3 is about 30 kiloparsecs. That's an extreme model. More typical models, like 1 arc second is about 8 kiloparsecs, 4 kiloparsecs, we also did it for even the smaller ones. And again, above what we think are the reasonable thresholds, we should see anywhere from a few hundred to tens of thousands of Van't Lyman alpha systems in the Hubble ultra deep field. So the bottom line is we should be able to detect lots of them. They should really show up like crazy. All right, so in the time remaining, I'll just describe the results of we went and did a search for these objects using the visual image of the Hubble ultra deep field. It has an incredibly accurate point spread function of about only 0.09 arc seconds. And so using the unsmooth image, we found about 11,000 objects down to the point source limit of 30.5 magnitude, visual magnitude. But interestingly, none of these objects satisfied the criteria for in-situ star formation at the Kennecott rate. And what I mean by that is, remember, the maximum column density that we've seen is about 10 to the 22 particles per square centimeter. If you put an object like that at a redshift of 3, it would have a surface brightness 26 magnitudes per square arc second. So everything we should see should be fainter than that. And as I said, there are lots of arguments for assuming that DLAs have a higher an angle diameter of at least 0.25 arc seconds. So none of the objects that we saw satisfied this criterion.
Sorry, could you say that again more simply?
The criterion is that, as I said, the maximum column density for a DLA is 10 to the 22. If I put an object, so 10 to the 22 corresponds to a star formation rate peanut area. It has to be dimmer than that, exactly, if it's a DLA. Now, if it's the objects that Bruce is going to talk about, higher column densities, then you can satisfy that criterion. But I'm sticking just to DLAs. And as I said, there are lots of reasons for believing they're at least 2 kiloparsecs in diameter. All right, so we're looking for extended objects. So what we did is we removed all the high surface brightness objects and set the continuum equal to the median sky brightness. And then we smoothed the what remained with Gaussian kernels, okay, which had a width, a theta current, full width half maximum, to enhance the signal to noise when we had a match kernel condition. In other words, when the full width half maximum, the smoothing kernel, equal the full width half maximum of the actual object, then you get a maximum signal to noise. This is a well-known result in statistics. So we did this for a series of smoothing kernels between a quarter of an arc second to 4 arc seconds. So what we found was very surprising. Okay, here is the number of detected objects versus the kernel width. Okay, and you can see it declines very rapidly, but the number of objects we're finding are much, much less than we predicted. I mean, for a quarter of an arc second, we predicted something like thousands, 10,000 objects. We're only finding 166. For 1 arc second, we expected about 1,000. We only detect 1, and then 2 and 4 arc seconds, we didn't detect anything. So what this says is that low surface brightness objects that are extended are very rare in the Hubble ultra deep field. And this is just to show you how we do this. Here it's just, for the half arc second kernel, we found 12 objects. And I'm just showing images of four of these. This is the Z-band, I-band visual blue. And I hope you can see it, a little faint smudge here. Can you see it? Yeah, okay. And it shows up in all of these. And here we stretch the image, you know, so you can just get it better. And this is a very faint object, 28.7 magnitude. But then when you apply the smoothing kernel on it, you can see the signal to noise really goes up dramatically. So if these objects are there, we're going to detect them. Okay. We're not going to miss them.
Didn't you also just look at the histogram of pixel values on the map, 606, because it's like a third of the sky is filled with these things, so you should see this.
Yeah, we don't. So what are these objects? Well, the one of the problems of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, it does not have U-band sensitivity, so we can't use the Steidel technique of using U-band dropouts. In fact, my student Mark Rafelski is going to go down to Keck next month, and he's going to make a very sensitive U-band images using the Keck telescope, and that will really be able to determine what these objects are and what other objects are. But what we think right now is that what most of these objects that we detected are intermediate redshift dwarf galaxies. They're consistent with that. But for argument's sake, I'm going to assume all of them are between a redshift of 2.5 and 3.5, and that will give me an upper limit to the co-moving density of these objects. So schematically, what I'm saying, every object we detect, I don't really know whether it's true, it's probably not true, but I'm going to say that they're between 2.5 and 3.5, and that gives me an upper limit.
And you looked at the second
thing,
11,000.
Yeah. Removed all of them. Yeah. These are the ones that we detected. Okay. And for example, for the 2 and 4 arc second kernel where we didn't detect it, so what we're determining a 95% confidence upper limit. So when we detect 0, the 95% confidence upper limit is 3. Okay. And we know what the co-moving density is for the Hubble Ultra Deep Field in this redshift interval. So that way I can get an upper limit to the co-moving density for each kernel. Okay, because I have a different value for the 95% confidence upper limit. So the co-moving star formation density is just that co-moving density times what we think the star formation rate is that we can detect. And we just did Monte Carlo simulations, just pushing objects as far out as we can before we could not see them anymore, and let that be the luminosity and therefore the star formation rate. And we also calculated thresholds for the surface brightness using the same type of simulations. And this is what we found. Okay, this is the result. So what I'm plotting is that same thing I had before, but now not against column density, I'm plotting this against surface brightness, because remember, at a redshift of 3, column density is star formation rate Peanut era, and equal to surface brightness. So here's the theoretical prediction, and these are our upper limits. And this is the upper limit for the 4 arc second kernel, 2 arc second, 1 arc second, 0.6, 0.5, 0.4, 0.3, 0.25. They go up and down for various reasons, but the main point is that they're all well below the predictions. Well below. I mean, not just the fact of 2 or 3, but the fact of 32 orders of magnitude. So, anyway, you want to look at this. Something is wrong with applying the Kennicott law to these objects at high redshift, even though we heard various simulations last week of people using them, which I found aggravating. Okay, so what's the explanation? I mean, just from a phenomenological point of view, one way to look at it is you just have to decrease the Kennicott normalization constant. Okay, if you decrease, here's the prediction for the constant that he finds. If you decrease it by a factor of 10, well, you satisfy some of the upper limits. You don't have to decrease it by a factor of 20, of 100 rather, probably a factor of 20 will do. So, you know.
Assuming they're not dwarf and intermediate redshift, the one you find.
Well, that's right. That's right. But that's, you know, I'm assuming that they're all at that redshift, and this is a conservative assumption. So what this means is that for a given column density, star formation rate Peanut area has to be 1/20th of what you predict from the Kennicott law, and that's—I think there's no way out of that right now.
Well, you can just raise the threshold.
Well, yeah, okay. That's a physical explanation. This is a phenomenological. I think what you're saying is right. I think what's going on is the thresholds are much higher.
But the threshold shouldn't be fixed column; it should be where Q is less than one, and more galaxies.
Well, let me show you. I think it goes up for a different reason. Yeah. I think it goes up with redshift because of some cosmological reasons. All right.
Can I ask again about the community that observations? I mean, you have the column density from the absorption. How do you deduce the size?
We don't know the size.
So how do you deduce the Kerman factor is a third? Because
the Kerman factor doesn't depend on, well, one out of three damp Lyman alpha system shows.
But so how did you get a size when you wanted to start looking at smoothing kernel?
Oh, I'm saying I take a range of sizes about what I think are plausible from various models. Okay. There are a couple of cases DLAs have been seen in emission, and it looked like ordinary galaxies. They're about 10 kiloparsecs, but that's a very small number of statistics. So I took a whole range of sizes, a range of sizes which I think are plausible. But I don't, as you said, I don't know the size for every object. But I do know the covering factor very well.
But I guess what I was wondering, that maybe you still have the same problem, is if what you're measuring in a damp Lyman alpha system is essentially commensal on some particular line of sight for the quasar. And if the star formation is patchy, you could have very compact star formation at higher, associated with damp Lyman.
Yeah, but remember, we have 1,000 of these objects. So that's what you're saying is it's going to have to be very, well, I think.
Well, I'm wondering, are any of the 11,000, if you look for association of the 11,000 things, well, you don't know what they're going to be.
No.
Like some of your 11,000 things were compact star formation.
Well, they probably are. Yeah. Oh, they may be.
Well, yeah. They probably are, but what he's saying is that on the average, the disk around this object region is still forming a star at a lower rate of temperature.
Yeah.
Even if they're around those.
Yeah, the upper limit still holds. There's no way around that.
It's like averaging the property of the disk around one of those rocks.
That's right.
Yeah, but you've already thrown out any bright regions. So
sure.
It would be kind of like looking at, a 51 and removing, all the bright regions and then looking at star formation.
That's right. I'm looking for the ambient star formation. Now, I think, I'm not saying there's no star formation in damp Lyman alpha system. What I'm saying is that there's no in situ star formation throughout the gas that we're seeing, that probably there are very compact regions, maybe one or two. You can't have too many, because too many, the result goes back to this. All right, so let me answer both your questions, in fact, I'm going to get to that. So anyway, just from looking at this, the data this way, this is the co-moving star formation density for the Lyman break galaxies, and this is the upper limit for DLA, so it's really well below. This is corrected for reddening. This is the one that's not corrected for reddening. All right, so what's the explanation? So there are two possibilities, and one of which has been mentioned already. I'll just start out with one. The one is that the molecular content of the gas is very low. Okay, so supposing that some of these objects are tomb rate unstable, they have column densities greater than the critical column density, but because the molecular fraction is so low, the gas cannot cool below the fine structure limit of 50 Kelvin. Yeah, I mean, you really need rotational transitions with much small energy separations to get it very cold. As I said before, the median molecular content is incredibly low in DLAs compared to the galaxy. And in most models, like the Krumholtz-McKee model that I've seen, the star formation rate is dictated by the molecular fraction. Thus, you might even have gravitationally bound clouds, but they're atomic clouds and they cannot collapse to form stars. But not everybody likes that explanation. And I think, to me, a more fundamental explanation is that I think the disks may be subcritical. The DLAs may be subcritical. Now, why do I say that? Well, here's the column density distribution function schematically. As I said, it goes like n to the minus 2 out to this break column density, and above that, it's consistent, although not uniquely determined, to go like n to the minus 3. I'm going to assume it goes like n to the minus 3. And the reason I like that is if I have randomly oriented disks, that's exactly what you predict. Okay, if the disk had, when the break column density turns out will be equal to the maximum central column density that you see in the disk. And so if I have randomly oriented disks, okay, what you get is all the column densities above the break are not intrinsic. They get larger and larger because the angles of inclination get larger. So you're coming in, more edge on, and that's why you're getting higher column density. They're not intrinsically higher. And so what you can do, okay, once you know that it goes like, well, we know this very well, it goes like n to the minus 2, you can infer what the column density is as a function of radius from the column density distribution function. And so basically what it goes is like r to the minus 2. And I'm plotting this over here as a fraction of the virial radius, because I want to put all this in the context of dark matter halos. Okay. So one of the free parameters here, of course, is the how big you assume that the disk is. I've used what's called the Mohr-Malm-White models, where the size of the disk is basically equal to the spin parameter, the angular momentum in dimensionless units, times the virial radius of the disk. So this is a normal angular momentum parameter. This is a higher than normal. This is a lower than normal, just to give you an idea, as a function of the virial radius.
Okay.
And the nice thing now is we can determine what the critical density is. So we know that the critical density for Q of 1 is given by this formula over here, where kappa is the epicyclic frequency, sigma is the velocity of dispersion of the gas. We think we know this very well. The velocity of dispersion of the gas, if you look at the DLA profiles, they're never much narrower, any narrower. They're always resolved. And when you fit them, the most narrow profiles are always about, have a sigma of 7 or 8 kilometers a second, just like the Milky Way. And some of the wider ones are multi-component systems. But what about the epicyclic frequency? Now, in the spherical collapse model for galaxy formation that Peebles and others have come up with, what's interesting, at a redshift of z, the angular velocity of the rotating gas in a dark matter halo is given by 10 times the Hubble parameter. Doesn't matter how big they are, how massive they are, you always get this result, okay? And of course, this Hubble parameter goes up almost an order of magnitude as you go to higher redshift. Now, of course, the epicyclic frequency is a function of the angular, of the rotation speed, okay, the angular velocity. And so I can calculate that, okay, assuming some type of rotation curve, okay? And then normalize it to this quantity over here at the virial radius. So for example, for a flat rotation curve, the epicyclic frequency goes like square root of 2 times the angular velocity at the virial radius, and it goes like 1 over r. So here it is. Here's for a flat rotation curve. This is what you get for the, once I know the epicyclic frequency, then I go back and calculate the critical column density. So here's the critical column density for a flat rotation curve. And I've divided by the mean molecular weight to get it, to make it the H1 column density. And you can see it's above these rotation curves. At a redshift of 0, all these curves are translated down by a factor of 10. So a significant fraction of the gas would be tumor unstable. But over here, much of the gas is not tumor unstable. And I've also done this for a Navarro-Franken-White rotation curve, which everybody uses.
So at a redshift of 0, in this simple model, you'd actually recover the pressure radius for...
Roughly speaking, it works, yeah. That's one of the things I worried about. Otherwise, I wouldn't believe this. So this may have something to do with it. My own feeling, it's probably a combination of both. I think, unless it's gravitationally unstable, it may be that the gas, most of the gas we're looking at is very low in molecules, but when you collapse the gas and you increase the surface density such that it becomes self-shielding, you can form molecules in various regions. Yeah, they all have the same sigma. That's the assumption I'm making. And the evidence, I think, so far is consistent with that. As I said, when we look at, I don't know if I have it on this, let's see, I might have some profiles here somewhere. Maybe not in this. Oh wait, here. Yeah. So this is typically what we see in Dent-Myman alpha systems. These are the velocity profiles. They're multi-component systems. But so this one has, I forgot exactly what the delta v is, about 70 kilometers a second. But there's a wide range of these velocity intervals, and they never get below, you get down to a single component, and it's always has a sigma of about 7 or 8 kilometers a second. So I'm assuming that a lot of this velocity spread is due to some systematic velocities. Okay. But the velocity dispersion, I think, is just like the Milky Way. Yeah.
So I get worried that when you see the DLA, you're not seeing a single thin disk. You're passing through a group of galaxies.
I think for the wide ones, I think you're right. For this one, I don't think so. I mean, for, you know, this is, these are pretty close in velocity. Okay. But go ahead. So what's
your... Well, I was thinking, I mean, the damp hydrogen profile represents the total gas column density through multiple dense fragments, then...
The column density per fragment will be lower.
It could be significantly lower.
Sure. Physically, I think it's going to be tough to do, because you remember that the ionizing background radiation at that redshift is very high, and it's about 100 times what it is locally. So the calculations that we've done, if you take a column density anything less than a few times 10 to the 20 and make the density, you know, less than 0.5, 0.4, the gas becomes ionized. And we have lots of evidence that this gas is neutral. So I think you can play that game a little bit, but you cannot reduce the column density per object much less than few, probably 3 or 4 times 10 to the 20.
Yeah, but that argument makes sense. What's still bothering me is these pair of the quasars, the Sorrels and Giovanni, the metal lines and the winds. I mean, one of the surprises we had was that after we looked at like just 5 pairs, we found several coincidents. Damp line and alpha systems in the two sight lines. The physical separation of the two sight lines was like 100 kiloparsecs.
So you're saying what, there are different redshifts, slightly different redshifts, is that what you're saying?
They're very similar redshifts.
Similar, but nonetheless distinct. I mean, you can tell the difference in the metal lines.
Two sight lines.
Okay.
The separation of the sight lines. 100
kiloparsecs. Yeah. Oh, 100 kiloparsecs. Sorry.
100
okay.
Kiloparsecs.
Yeah.
Basically the same redshift. I mean,
what was the redshift? I'm just curious.
3.
Okay. So what's your point then?
Well, surely a single disk.
It's not 100 kiloparsecs. I agree with that. Sure.
So we were forced to conclude that this isn't a disk that we're intercepting, but it's some sort of
multiple.
Sure. Gas,
tidal
yeah.
The
that was.
I have to go back and look, but I mean, I think it was like 100 to 200.
Yeah, so that was cool.
Yeah, these are. That's above our median, but sure. I mean, I look. I agree. Once you get above, go a little higher than that. I would say 150 kilometers a second, because remember, this is there are all these projection effects. The real velocity differences are much higher than that. Then I think you're right that they're probably not going to be single systems. And, you know, although what's interesting, you know, is that a lot of the chemical properties are very uniform. See, that's one thing that surprised me. If you look, so you would think if you're going to different systems that, you know, the star formation rates would be different. There'd be more dust in one and not in the other. That's not what we see. They're very chemically uniform. If you look at the ratios of, you know, silicon to iron or some of these other elements, or even these things that I've been working on, the carbon two fine structure lines, those ratios are incredibly uniform. But I hear what you're saying. That's an interesting point. Okay, so I guess that's basically, you know, yeah, right. Yeah, here we go. So this is summarizing what I'm saying is that these objects are very extended, and but what's interesting, the low incidence of these faint galaxies in the UDF implies a very low star formation efficiency of gas at high redshift. And I want simulators to be aware of this. They don't seem to, I mean, a lot of the simulators just keep using this Kennecott-Schmidt law at these low column densities, and it just makes no sense to me. And as I said, the star formation efficiency is much lower in this gas. Why that's true, I don't really know. I think it's probably some combination. As I said, the gas might be subcritical to low molecular content. So I think the bottom line, as far as I'm concerned, is that star formation high redshift is confined to compact cores. And in this talk I gave last week, I said that a significant fraction of BLAs may have these compact Lyman break galaxies in them. Thanks. Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, that's not totally consistent right now. The I mean, the upper limit that I'm getting, yeah, that is a problem. Let's see. I didn't have time to talk about that. Yeah. I might have it somewhere. The predicted, here we go. So this is the metallicities that we find as a function of redshift. This is what our upper limit implies. So we're about a factor of 3 below. Now, but what's interesting, remember last week I was saying there are 2 populations of BLAs. One's had low cooling rates, the other that have high cooling rates. So for the low cooling rate objects, the median metallicity is right over here. So this upper limit is not catastrophic. But for the others, you know, the more metal-rich systems, the upper limit of the star formation rate that we see cannot account, to the amount of metals predicted. Now remember, this is a model. Okay, this is Ken Nagamini's model that he worked out with Springle and Hernquist, so it implies a certain time history of star formation. But it's normalized to star formation at a redshift of 3, and that's how I was able to lower it. So where the metals come from is not fully understood.
So a few years ago, Yoshi Shire had an analytical physical model that predicted the outer edge of the crust.
Yeah.
In which it's a combination of self-shielding, which allows the creation of a cold neutral medium, which then creates a thin, which then produces molecular shock.
Yeah.
So has anyone extended that in redshift to higher?
I think he's thought about that. I've heard him speak about it. My only worry about that model is that he predicts once you get a cold phase, it automatically becomes terrain unstable and forms stars. Yeah, but I'm saying the numbers he put in, that's what happened, and that's not what we see. I think we see a lot of cold phase gas that's in pressure equilibrium that's not gravitationally bound. But I thought it was a very nice piece. Good question. All right. Talk about it later. Yeah.